Hello, beautiful people. Welcome to this week's episode of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. I'm the host and producer of the Happy Hour, Olga Peters, and I'm happy to welcome to today's show State Auditor Doug Hoffer. Hello, Doug. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm glad you're here. And if you've been watching the news, listeners and viewers, the auditor's office just released a report entitled Jay Peak, Burke Mountain, and ANC Bio Vermont EB5 Fraud, an assessment of the state's role. So this is in response to, as many of you may know, the EB5 investment program, where Ariel Quiros, Bill Kelly, and Bill Stenger had taken in millions and millions of investments from foreign investors who were part of the EB5 program, who in exchange for investing in American projects in economically depressed areas could receive a green card. And that was the deal. And unfortunately, it fell apart in so many ways. And Ariel Quiros, Bill Kelly, and Bill Stenger were charged on a various numbers of fraud, wire fraud, and there was another charge.
There were some securities issues as well.
Thank you. And these were all around projects up at Jay Peak, Burke Mountain, and then a few projects in downtown Newport. So, Doug, part of the role of your office is to look at state government and make sure that it's using taxpayers' money effectively, transparently, and well. And I'm wondering, how did this report or this issue come before your office? Because, you know, things have been happening in this realm, this EB5 fraud, as many people have been calling it, or the Kingdom Con, as it seems to be called in the press right now, since, you know, mid-2000s. So this is not a new issue, and VT Digger has been reporting on it in depth for many years now. So why this report now?
As you said, my office typically focuses on the expenditures of state funds for programs by departments and agencies on behalf of taxpayers and others. This did not involve much taxpayer money, frankly, as you defined the program correctly. It's a combination of development, economic development, and investment securities opportunity for offshore folks. Here, the only state expenditures until the litigation began was to operate a regional center, so-called, which oversees and regulates and assists the various EB5 projects. Vermont had the only state-sponsored regional center in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite sure why they chose to do that. I have an idea, but I don't want to assume. So since they weren't spending a lot of money, we didn't spend any time on it.
Mm.
And even though starting in 2012 or so, there began to be inklings of problems.
Right.
And they had been going on for a little while. But to your comment before, the program, at least for the Jay Peak projects, and there were seven or eight of them, things were going okay for the first few years.
Mm-hmm.
Work was being done at Jay Peak, on the lodge, on related facilities and so forth. And the investors, felt reasonably secure about what was going on.
And jobs were being created, which is one of the other goals of the EB5 program.
Yes, although I'd like to come back to jobs, if you'll help me remember that down.
Yes, I will make a note.
Very important issue. So in any case, when things started to become known that there were problems, VT Digger was part of that. They assisted in the disclosure of some stuff that turned out to be the beginnings of, a very serious investigation by major players, including the SEC and the state of Vermont and so forth. And early in that process, the Attorney General's office had gone after Quiros and Stenger and come to a settlement with them. This was before some of the criminal litigation began, and before the SEC settled and all that stuff. But once the AG felt like they had done at that point all that was required and appropriate, TJ Donovan, the prior attorney general, turned to me and said, "Here's Doug," because he felt as though he had done all his office could do and that we were better situated to do an investigation specifically about the role of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, much was already known about the behavior of the developers. Not all, but much. Mm-hmm. And I said, what the heck? And we started to do the work, which involved accessing hundreds of thousands of documents, emails, all sorts of stuff. And what happened is then the serious litigation began. See, it was not done, nor was the Attorney General's office done. So,
and this is more at the federal level litigation.
It's federal and state.
Yeah. Okay.
Federal and state. There were criminal cases and civil cases and so forth. So professional standards for auditors effectively require us under those circumstances to step back.
Mm-hmm.
And allow the investigations and legal matters to proceed without interference. And that's what we did. So we pretty much sat on it for a couple of years or more. When the last case, not the criminal case, the criminal case was done a couple of years ago. People went to jail and so forth. Two of them were already out, Kelly and Stenger. Kiros is still behind bars. But then there was a case brought by an attorney on behalf of some of the investors.
Mm-hmm.
So that litigation held us up again for another year and a half or more. That was settled this past fall. And that was the source of what you alluded to earlier about the money.
Mm-hmm.
I think the attorneys for the investors were effectively arguing negligence on behalf of the state.
Okay.
It was a settlement that didn't admit to intentional negligence or anything else. Basically said there were some problems, but we're going to get rid of this. We're going to make this go away. Enough already.
Mm-hmm.
And the attorney on behalf of the investors agreed. They signed the papers. The state owes $16.5 million, which is a lot of money. And the insurance companies wouldn't cover most of that, which is kind of interesting in itself. But once that was done, we could get back to work. And we did. And this report reflects the second half of the story, because we did issue a preliminary report several years back,
right,
describing the program, just so that people would have that. Not that it hadn't been done, but not all in one place. This report was intended to answer the question, what did the state do or not? Is there anything that hasn't already been brought forward that's included in the materials that were part of the discovery and the lawsuit and so forth? And the answer is, it's complicated, but I can say with certainty that we found no evidence of corruption within state government, none. And that doesn't surprise me. I've been on the job for over 11 years. And while when I took the job back in January of 13, I took office, there had been a couple of frauds within state government.
Mm.
And then there were one or two others in the first couple of years of my tenure. Thankfully, since then, as far as we know, there haven't been any others.
Right.
I don't know why that is, because you hear about corruption in state government all over the country, but not so much here, thankfully.
Thankfully. Well, I want to just pause there and make sure that we're all on the same page, because we're talking about things that can have different definitions in different realms. So there's like legal definitions in some cases, and there might be what you and I over the coffee cups at breakfast chatting might call something. So I would love if we could just drill down briefly on the difference between fraud and corruption, negligence. Like if we could just sort of
I'm not representing the Attorney General's office. I'm not here as a lawyer. I really don't want to go that deep into that stuff. What I can tell you is that I think everyone listening and watching would agree, we have an idea what corruption is.
Mm-hmm.
That's a government official taking money from someone and doing something for them, whether it's giving them a permit to build something, you know, whether it's turning the other way if a construction job used bad, cheap materials and it's going to fall down, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Old traditional corruption. That's not what we found. We didn't find any.
Perfect. That's as much as a definition as I needed. I just wanted to make sure listeners were on the same page.
Now, fraud was committed by the developers.
Mm-hmm.
They defrauded the investors at a couple of steps along the way. Although, as I mentioned, in the early years, they actually took the money that was invested and used it to build stuff. And we'll get back to the jobs thing. But it was the latter parts of this entire enterprise that really blew the door off, because things were coming to a head. And I think primarily Kiros, but also clearly the courts believed Stenger and Kelly as well, were part of this scheme that was misrepresenting itself, that didn't have the goods.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we can get to some of the particulars if you like. But back to make it more linear, the state decided way back when to be the administrator and creator of the regional center, which was responsible for all EB5 projects in Vermont. And there are others. They're not just limited to JP. And the others have never had these kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. Sugar Bush had one, Mount Snow had one, and so forth. And they're doing fine, as far as we can tell. So that center had what the Agency of Commerce, which was given responsibility to create it and house it and staff it, had very limited responsibilities based on what the state understood was the federal government's expectations. Mm-hmm. Basically, to review proposals, to approve them or not, they had to eventually be approved by the feds as well, and then to navigate the process going forward, which had a lot to do with jobs and assisting them with marketing and so forth. And that's basically what ACCD, the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, thought was the limit of their obligations. Mm. That was part of the problem. Because as you pointed out earlier, the word you used was it was an investment program. Well, that was the case for the investors themselves. But here in the state, it wasn't state money. It wasn't even Americans' money. Mm-hmm. These were non-citizens. And interestingly, the program years prior, it'd been around for a long time, EB5, like 30 years or more.
Well, and the Vermont Center predates the JP project even,
yes,
right?
Yeah. But there had been problems before with EB5 around the country, including mm-hmm. fraud.
Right.
So every 5 or 10 years, there was a fix. Congress would say, oh my God, including former Senator Leahy, who was a big supporter of EB5. And he would always say, oh my God, what went wrong this time? Let's fix it and move on. And they did that several times. So I mentioned that only because I'm surprised a little bit and disappointed that the Agency of Commerce didn't see that this was more than just a marketing deal to get stuff built in Vermont. People, not Vermonters, but people were investing money in these projects. Mm-hmm. So there was, even though the SEC wasn't involved, prior to this, what happened with EB5, the SEC did not focus on this program at all. Having said that, there's no reason why people in Vermont couldn't have at least thought to themselves, hey, this does have a securities element to it. And I'll tell you why there were hints of that shortly thereafter. So the state really didn't assume that they had much responsibility and no responsibility with regard to the securities side. And that's mm-hmm. a problem because they didn't bring to bear the resources necessary to do that, which are not within the Agency of Commerce. As you know, later on, when things really boiled and bubbled, Governor and the Agency of Commerce understood that they needed help from the Department of Financial Regulation, which did have the legal authority and the tools and skill sets to do this work.
Right.
And it's curious that it didn't occur to the state at the outset that there was this problem of the dual mission, marketing, regulation, because we already had a well-established and well-respected program that did just that. It's called captive insurance, which is managed and administered jointly by the Agency of Commerce and the Department of Financial Regulation. There was already a model for this, but they didn't do it. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I don't believe there was any bad intent. It just didn't occur to them, which says a lot, frankly, in my opinion. This is not evidence from the audit, but in my opinion, it says a lot about the culture of the Agency of Commerce. Hmm. They embrace their role as assisting the business community and marketing and you know, trying to make things happen. That's their job. Mm-hmm. But you can't not acknowledge the other half of the story. And we'll get back to why this is important and why it's a big takeaway from this whole effort on our part.
Yeah.
So shortly after things started to roll and were going okay in the first couple of years at JP, a guy came forward in 2011 who I know had worked with them on developing offering materials. He was not from Vermont. He's from Miami, I think, or Florida. And he publicly came forward and said, I can't work with those guys anymore.
Right.
I don't trust them. You know, he did have a meeting with his attorney and some officials from the state, but he didn't give them much information.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is the secretary of the Agency of Commerce went to Bill Stenger and said, what's going on here? This guy alleges A, B, and C. And Stenger basically said, it's just a business dispute. Don't worry about it. And by the way, here are some records that you can look at that prove me right. The then agency secretary was a very smart guy, but he wasn't an accountant or an auditor.
Right.
And moreover, he was being given records at Stenger's choosing. Not all the records, just the ones he wanted him to see. So effectively, that ended that little quirky moment in time, which was a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
At about the same time, by the way, he also said that he believed that there was $13 million missing from their bank accounts.
The person who had come forward,
right,
who I think was a CPA, actually.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, you have the state being told without proof, but that their antenna should have gone up.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, the secretary did meet with Stenger and ask him about it, but he walked away satisfied with what he had been told.
Mm-hmm.
A short time later, another guy came forward with what was a comparatively minor technical issue, which was he alleged that the developers were using unlicensed brokers at some point in the process of marketing these securities. Again, that's not a big deal in and of itself, but it is another moment in time when somebody sort of said, what? What'd you say? Tell me that again. But they didn't. DFR, Department of Financial Regulation, chose not to pursue that.
Mm.
So those were moments where, even though they didn't start with this dual effort by DFR and ACCD, they could have come together and said, maybe ACCD could have said, as they did 2 or 3 years later, we need your help.
Right.
Because DFR had subpoena power, had a lot of stuff that the Agency of Commerce didn't have. So that was unfortunate. Other things that happened that reflect choices missed. In the beginning, when they opened the center, the agency obtained some memoranda of agreement that they got from the feds. They said, well, here's a template you could use. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. It helped them. They didn't have to make it up on their own. They said, oh, this is good. Let's use this. Because we know it pushed all the buttons that the feds wanted. Well, that's true to a point, but that doesn't mean you couldn't add things to it,
right,
as long as the feds didn't object. And I say that because after the guy broke faith with the developers and tattled on him, and by the way, we think he was probably the whistleblower for the SEC, which didn't tell the state what it was doing for a long time, that led an employee of the agency who was working at the center to recommend to the secretary and others, hey, we should get Stenger to do an audit, which was exactly what should have been done.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get Stenger to do the audit. You get somebody from outside to do it. But anyway, Stenger agreed. But after 4 months, he told the center that he wasn't going to do it. He said, too expensive. We're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. Don't need that.
Right.
So they missed the opportunity. And they claimed, they being the agency, claimed that they couldn't force the issue because it wasn't specifically in the MOU, the agreement with the developers.
Oh, okay.
I think they could have pushed it, but they chose not to. I mention this because about a year later, the developers wanted to revise the MOUs for a couple of projects that became the real problem, Burke Mountain and ANC Bio, and said, can we amend, revise, change the MOUs? And the state said, well, yeah, okay. That was a moment when the state had leverage, and they still did not include an audit requirement, which is another enormous missed opportunity. That doesn't mean anything would have happened overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It should have been evident that was the right thing to do.
An audit is the process that would have most likely highlighted money that was missing or money that had been misdirected or money that just was not being used as it was promised to be used.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's a problem. And I don't know, again, I don't know why everybody was busy. Part of what I think happened is that the guy who was the face of the developers, mm-hmm. Bill Stenger, had been working in the Northeast Kingdom for years, was very well respected, had a good career, you know, he presented well, and a lot of people in the Agency of Commerce in that world knew him and trusted him. That's what fraudsters rely on in many cases. People don't know you, they're less likely to take you at your word.
Mm-hmm.
They did know him and they trusted him. And that's just life. You know, human beings do that stuff. It doesn't make them bad or corrupt. It means they didn't keep or ensure that arm's length objective business relationship.
Which I think happens a lot in Vermont, especially in our small communities, because we base so much on our relationships, which has positives and negatives. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just kind of how we operate.
Yeah, I've reported on that being a problem in the Agency of Commerce many times,
in particular
the Agency of Commerce. But a couple of other examples of moments in time that didn't really work out. Let me back up. The state, when it created the center, didn't do a very important thing. If you start a new enterprise like that, that you've never done before, and that typically is only done by private entities who have a profit motive as opposed to us, and you're putting the state's reputation at risk, you really should sit down with all your people and say, okay, we're going to run this center. We should have policies and procedures. I want to sound like a nerdy auditor type, but that's what my auditors always say to me when we start a job. Do they have policies and procedures?
Right.
Because that gives you something to measure their performance against. They never developed policies and procedures for the regional center. Never. Mm-hmm. And I think had they done that, which is really best practice, that conversation probably would have included what I discussed before about the wisdom of having the two parties come together, DFR and ACCD, work together on regulating and marketing and so forth. And that didn't happen, which is too bad.
Another finding in your report was going back to this discussion around audits, how in a number of marketing materials, including a video that featured Governor Shumlin, who was governor at the time, the state publicly said, we are overseeing this program. That's one reason your money is safe. We are doing audits, and that what was being said and what was being practiced were not necessarily the same thing.
No, and for the record, I don't believe the governor intentionally misled people.
I don't think so either. I think,
you know, governors cut ribbons. They talk to people all the time. It's remarkable. All of us public figures don't screw up more often, but he just said something that he probably knew as soon as he said it, he shouldn't have said.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, that video, which was directed by Bill Stenger, by the way, was used for a year and a half before the state even learned about its existence.
Right.
And that feeds back to something I'll mention now, and that is two of the things in the memorandum of understanding with all the projects and the investors was that the center itself agreed to have quarterly meetings. Okay, what does that mean?
Yeah,
well,
I have a question.
Because they didn't have policies and procedures, they didn't have effectively real guidance for the center's director to say, okay, we're having our quarterly meeting. Here's my agenda. Here's the documents that I want. Here's the questions I want answered and so forth. Not to make it adversarial, but just to build a record.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do that. They didn't even record actually when the meetings took place. Although there is evidence from email traffic that they did occur. We don't know when. We don't know what they talked about. There were no records. That's just bad form.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Bad form.
As a journalist reading that part of the report, I'm like, public record, public meeting law? Like, what happened here?
Yeah. So it's unfortunate. And the developers had convinced the successive directors of the center that everything you need to know is right here. They would give them some spreadsheets, but the state never took those documents with them.
Mm.
When the meeting was over, everybody went their separate way. Not only was there not a record kept or made, but they didn't take those records back to their office to review them at their leisure in private, maybe with the help of a CPA, whatever. They didn't do that.
Interesting.
It's just odd. And some of these people, by the way, are smart, capable people who I think trusted them too much. And
yeah.
But then when things got a little squirrely a little later on, the denial of the developers to meet the expectations of the state should have been, I think, a huge tip off that they were hiding something. Because there were many, many back and forths over time between the center and the developers about, okay, your offerings for the security say the following things. We're not sure we can approve all of what you're saying. And they'd say, what's the problem? Back and forth, tick tock, time goes by. And the state later in the game actually threatened to cancel some projects because of these disagreements about the offerings and so forth. And thankfully, at one point, the attorney for the agency, the in-house attorney, general counsel, understood that they were getting into areas that he didn't have any experience in or knowledge of, securities-related stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He went to the attorney general's office and said, can you help? And I don't have records of it, but I'm pretty sure I know what they said. We don't have that expertise.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what we do in the attorney general's office. If we need that, we go outside and hire private counsel. And that's what you should do. But that took a long time to get the approval of the secretary of the agency. And by the time they all got the input from those private counsel, it had been 20 months.
Wow.
From when the general counsel first said, I need help. We need help. That was the right instinct.
Mm-hmm.
But 20 months? Where's the urgency?
A lot of money can go missing in 20 months.
And it did.
Yeah.
And then towards the end, of course, when DFR did become involved, the pace quickened for mm-hmm. sure. They were ready. They did have the tools. They did have the experience. And they weren't that trustworthy.
Right.
They didn't have this friendly relationship with Bill Stenger over the decades. So they did some things that are very interesting and appropriate. The two projects at the end of the pipeline were, they call Q-Burk, Burk Mountain,
mm-hmm.
which had actually started. There was some construction had occurred, and this ANC bio thing, and thing is not a term of art, but it works. This was the weirdest of all.
Yeah.
Kiros apparently had a relationship with some people in Korea that at one time had a business that worked in biomedical equipment and research. I think by the time this came around here in Vermont, the company was bankrupt, much less than it had been before, whatever. It was a tool. It was a vehicle for Kiros primarily, I think, and the others knew about it, to say, hey, here's the deal for you. We're going to have these guys come to Newport. And that's when they had the famous ribbon cutting with all the guys who should have known better. You know, Leahy, Welch, Bernie, Shumlin, everybody and their brother were there. Said, oh, my God, look at the future for the Northeast Kingdom. It's going to be great. Well, when I heard that, I wasn't in this office at the time. When I heard that, I said, are you kidding? Really think an international biomedical facility is a good fit for Newport, Vermont? With no disrespect to Newport, where are the employees coming from?
Right.
This is not New York or Silicon Valley or a place with that kind of talent. It's just they're not there. Mm-hmm. They don't even have houses for that many people, you know, who want to buy $600,000 homes. So it was laughable to me at the time, right. But they went along with it because, again, these are our friends. It sounds great. You know, and if you're a governor or a public official, you're not going to turn your nose up at what may be a great ride for your people, your communities, your state. That's what they all hoped for. Mm-hmm. And that's what they were being promised. But, you know, it just didn't make any sense. So eventually some things happened. For example, the Agency of Commerce hired a temporary Korean-speaking intern.
Right.
Who could review some of the materials that were being provided over there and communications back and forth, which was smart. But at that point, it was a little late in the game. But DFR got into the game and things started to move very quickly, in part because DFR eventually started working with the SEC. And the SEC was further into this than the state was at that point. You know, a lot of things had happened, not just the obvious fraud of what was purported to be the ANC bio thing, but that's when they began to learn about how the money had been moving around from pot to pot for the earlier projects, mm-hmm. where there was actual evidence of money being spent, construction and so forth.
Right.
But we also know that Kiros took a lot of money out of those pots.
And supposedly padded a number of the estimates.
No. Well, actually, if I'm correct, and I say that with I think what I learned from our audit manager on this job is that Stenger was over budget on almost all those projects.
Okay.
And I think it's clear from the evidence that we saw that Kiros wasn't happy about that, but it worked out in some ways to his advantage. You know, more money to skim, I guess.
Gotcha.
So anyway, once DFR was involved, the pace picked up and it became clear that there was nowhere to hide. And what happened is they said to the developers, you may not get any more investors to the trough until we approve the latest offerings. And by the way, for ANC Bio, they said any money that comes in will not be given to the developers. It will go into an escrow account in our department, or I don't know exactly where it was situated, literally. Mm-hmm. And we will only release that money under certain conditions if something's going to be built, for example. It's a mm-hmm. real project because we don't see it right now. From that point forward, there had already been some ANC Bio investors, but from that point forward, there were quite a few, and millions of dollars were into that escrow account and were never released. To the developers. Right. Consequently, those investors got their money back. Oddly, the biggest fraud of all, ANC Bio, you know, I mean, Judge Crawford, the federal judge who had this case, called it a ghost. Mm-hmm. There was just nothing there. But all those people got their money back. On the other hand, having not built anything, there were no jobs.
Right. And they didn't get their green cards, too, which is one of the reasons the people invested in the first place.
The most important reason. And by the way, though, some of them did, because what the feds allowed, since the project was failing and there was obvious fraud at that point, they said, okay, we don't want to penalize those investors. We know that their money was withheld appropriately by the state. So we're going to allow you to transfer your investment to other projects over in New York or wherever mm-hmm. there's a good fit. And they did that.
Okay.
And I think some of those people did get green cards, but a lot didn't. The other project at the end of the tunnel, as I mentioned, was Burke.
Mm-hmm.
That's where there was some controversy within state government because, you know, clearly DFR felt that there was fraud in that project as well. But what happened is at some point, contractors, local folks, workers, elected officials started bugging the heck out of the governor, saying, Governor, what the heck's going on here? we're not getting paid. You know, we put in a lot of money, a lot of our own time. We've got employees who need to be paid. They have mortgages. What's going on here? So that was a challenge. In addition, the question about, well, should we have the escrow thing and just stop the whole process? Or should we have the escrow thing and find a way to allow some money to go out to complete the work? Because if they actually build out the Burke property, that's an asset. Mm-hmm. That's a real asset.
Right.
That either a receiver could take or has value and could be sold or whatever. And that was the back and forth within state government, because some said, you're enabling a fraud. And others said, yeah, but we're going to get contractors paid. They're Vermonters. They have employees who are Vermonters. And there's going to be something to hold on to at the end. Mm-hmm. So I can see why it was not a no-brainer, that there were, you could understand both sides.
Yeah.
There was some spats. In the end, what they did is create an escrow account. And this one said the money can only go out if this third party that they hired approved invoices.
Okay.
Only for construction, period. No money that was brought from the investors into the escrow could go to the developers themselves.
Gotcha.
Only to the project, which I'm not here to judge. It was what they did in the end.
Mm-hmm.
However, for a lot of reasons, the people at Q Burke, Burke Mountain, really were shafted. They're the ones who have the lowest percentage of green cards.
Okay.
For a lot of reasons, but the state, DFR, and other entities within the state have been working as best they can to persuade the feds to get their heads out of the dark place and have some sympathy for these investors who did nothing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And played by the rules. So I don't know how that's going to turn out. I know that part of the settlement this last fall included a reduction in the amount that the state would have to pay if they were successful mm-hmm. in assisting a significant number of investors to get their green cards. That's mm-hmm. an ongoing process. You know, there's a lot here, and I have talked endlessly and haven't allowed you to ask questions, so maybe I should, you know, do that.
No, I think this is a lot to chew on, Doug, and I'm going to encourage people, I'm going to link to the auditor's report in the show notes of this episode. So I encourage you to look through it. And it's an interesting read. And I really appreciate how the report lays out some early structural issues around the program and some early maybe red flags that people probably needed to pick up on. I think it's laid out in a really clear way. And unfortunately, we need to take a break and hear from some underwriters. And in the second half, I'd like to get back to jobs. And I also want to just talk about, you know, in the future, how do we prevent this from happening again, which I think is the more important issue. So stay tuned, everyone. We're going to hear from some underwriters on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the second half of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. I'm your host and producer of the show, and I'm speaking with Doug Hoffer, the state auditor for the state of Vermont. I want to quickly say thank you to Brattleboro Community Television for taking the video version of our show and sharing it with media centers around New England. And I also want to remind folks that I will be linking in the show notes to some of the documents that we're talking about here today. And you can find those at our podcast website, wherever you subscribe to podcasts or at the Montpelier Happy Hour .captivate.fm. Oh, and one last thing. Doug, just so you know, the views and opinions on the Montpelier Happy Hour are those of the host and the guest, and not the platform, not the radio station, not your colleagues, not state government, not anyone else but us. So if anyone's going to get in trouble, it will just be us for our own words coming out of our mouth. So thank you, Doug, for being here today and talking us through your report, the J.P. Burke Mountain and ANC Bio, Vermont EB-5 Fraud, an Assessment of the State's Role Report. If you're joining the show now, in the first half of the show, we were talking about the report itself and some of the findings that the office found. And in this part, we're going to be talking more about jobs and looking ahead. You know, how do we make sure that something like this fraud doesn't happen again in the state? And Doug, if you'll bear with me for a moment, you know, one thing I'm sitting with as I'm looking at this report and this conversation here is probably about 3 weeks ago, a friend and fellow journalist, Leah McGrath Goodman, was on the show, and she is getting her master's degree from the University of Suffolk in the UK, studying corruption. And I realize that what we're talking about now is not that full-blown foreign corruption that she is studying. But one thing she said that really stood out to me and I've been sitting with is, as someone who lives in Vermont, one of her concerns for Vermont in general, she feels we can be vulnerable to these types of misuse of funds that Ariel Quiros, Bill Kelly, and Bill Stenger engaged in with the J-Peak projects, because we tend to be economically disadvantaged and many of our small communities don't have an industry base or a jobs base. She feels that we are vulnerable to folks coming in and saying, hey, I have this shiny new project. It's going to bring all this money to the area. It's going to bring all these jobs, kind of like the ANC bio promises that were made behind those projects. And I've just been really sitting with that because I think she has a point. You know, I think back to my area of the state with the Hermitage Project down in Halifax at Haystack. And again, it was someone who came in, bought a lot of property, had all these projects, and it went bust for various reasons. I'm not saying there was fraud or corruption. And then it had to be straightened out, which it is slowly being straightened out, but the community suffers in the meantime. I'm curious for you, what are you sitting with, having gone through this report and seen all the documents in the court case?
Your concerns are well-founded, but I'm not aware of too much of that. But we do have something that for most passes the straight face test, but is no less, in my view, a waste of taxpayer money. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly what we're concerned about. You know, fraud can involve private sector parties ripping each other off, and that doesn't work for workers or communities, but we don't see too much of that here. But at the state level, we have some programs that are predicated on assumptions that are not supported by the evidence. Mm-hmm. And we give a lot of money away to businesses that say, have we got a deal for you? We're going to expand. We're going to have more workers. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And if you don't help us, we can go to South Carolina. Well, this has become a national joke, not us, but the whole idea of states being held hostage to an industry that shops businesses around to get money from these incentive programs. And Vermont's been doing it for 25 years. Luckily, we don't have the resources to do it nearly as big as most other states, but it's still money that should be invested for better purposes than just lining the pockets of some corporations. Having said that, we build the trough. I don't blame them for coming to the trough, We have some deeply flawed programs. But I'm not aware of a lot of fraud, frankly, mm-hmm. and thankfully.
But yes, that vulnerability of our economy sometimes, I do worry about that. I do worry that sometimes when someone comes in with a lot of money and those shiny new projects.
Well, I suspect that it's not so much that it would lead to fraud, although it can and has in other places and here. It's that those people, or those entities with that mm-hmm. much money, end up getting local and state officials to do things they might not otherwise do. Like give mm-hmm. a permit for something this big, when in fact, it might be better for all of us if it was only this big. Whether it's a development for housing, or not that we don't need lots of housing, we do, but the question is how much in what places and of what type, and also commercial and industrial development. So scale becomes a big deal. Mm. And what would have happened anyway? You know, if it's such a good idea, then why do you need us? If you have a good business plan, then do it. Anyway, I'm glad again that I'm not aware of a lot of pure fraud. Thank goodness. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk jobs, because one of the goals of the EB-5 program is job creation, especially in economically struggling communities. Did that happen with the J-Peak, Burke, ANC Bio projects?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked because, as you may know, your listeners and viewers may not, each time we do an audit, we invite the auditee or the entity that we're auditing or that has a direct involvement to provide management comments at the end, and then we append them to the report just as we get it. Mm-hmm. And if they say something's crazy, then we respond, which happens sometimes. We get the last word. But the response from the Agency of Commerce asserted that 6,000 jobs were created because of EB-5. And it's very near the end of the report. You'll see it. It's just a picture, a PDF of their one-page response from Joan Goldstein, who's the commissioner of the
department. Oh, yes. Yep.
Here's the deal on jobs. What the feds require is that applicants to the program come to a place like our center, if it has been approved as a project with an EB-5, and say, I've got 500 grand, and they go, great. You've got to get an economist to tell us that this particular investment at this time in this place will produce 10 jobs. For those who don't follow this stuff, there are direct jobs, indirect jobs, and induced jobs. The direct jobs are the ones where, at the end of the day, J-Peak expanded. More rooms, more facilities, more this, and people are actually hired by J-Peak to work there. And obviously, a lot of people were hired to do the construction work. Those are direct jobs. The indirect jobs are not crazy or unsurprising. If you build a hotel, for example, you need to fill it with furniture. Mm-hmm. The furniture is made somewhere. Chances are not too much of it made here, but some of it was. And other inputs of various kinds. You need carpet. You need lights. You need to pave the parking lot. You need to do all that stuff. So those are indirect because you're not paying someone to work at J-Peak, but you're buying a product or a service that's helping to make that happen.
Right.
Furthermore, all of the people who are either directly employed or indirectly get a paycheck. That money is spent on your mortgage or your rent, your car payment, your food, your computer, your software, your phone, all the stuff that people spend money on, healthcare. That is called induced. And those expenditures relate to jobs, fractions, of course, for each one of us. So there's all those three things. And that is what gets you to 10 jobs per person, not 10 actual full-time jobs at J-Peak.
Right.
But it bothers me a lot that the Agency of Commerce does not tell people that. They just say 6,000 jobs, when in fact, a lot of them don't exist anymore because they were construction jobs. That doesn't mean they didn't have value at the time. They did.
Mm-hmm.
For all those electricians and plumbers and folks who did that work, that was a big project that helped pay their bills, and that's a good thing.
Yes.
But when the project's completed, they're no longer employed there. Mm-hmm. Now you move into the jobs within the business, the front desk people, the chambermaids, whatever. Also available to people in an area, in this case, where there's not a lot of economic development. So that's right. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. You can leave aside the question of wages. That's a different But the point is to say, as Commissioner Goldstein did, EB-5 is responsible for 6,000 jobs is terribly misleading in my view. And I just don't like that the state misleads people. It bothers me a lot. Mm-hmm. And I had this same conversation with her predecessor almost 10 years ago when she was quoted in somewhere, Digger or somewhere else, saying, you know, at that point, 3,000 jobs. So I contacted her and I said, where's the evidence? What did you rely on to say that? And we had a back and forth that was torturous. As it turns out, she was relying on exactly what Commissioner Goldstein is relying on, which are the estimates from the economic model that was used on the front end to provide eligibility for the investor and on the back end to verify it. Because then you have to say, well, did you spend the money you promised to spend on construction for this, that, and the other? And if so, then we're going to take the model's assumptions for granted and say, well, you did it. Mm-hmm. You met the bar, you created the 10 jobs, you're good to go, you get your green card. You can't measure indirect and induced jobs without spending even more money than the project cost because they're not here. They're all over the Northeast. They're all over the country. They're all over the world. Mm-hmm. The models have merit. I've used them. They work. I trust them. But to say 6,000 jobs leads people to think, really? Here in Vermont? Wow. No, not so much.
Yeah.
So that bugs me.
And it bugs me too, because while every job is important, you're right. Not all of them are long lasting. They might be the 6 months that someone's working on building a building. But then you're right. You might have 100 jobs, but if they all pay minimum wage, that is a different amount of money flowing into the economy than if they paid medium or high income wages.
Yep. Yeah.
So let's talk about moving forward, because this is one of my philosophies as a journalist, for better or for worse. Mistakes happen. People screw up. Sometimes it's nefarious. Sometimes it's innocent. Sometimes it's somewhere in between.
Not but mistakes, my
auditors. Not, yeah, I'm sure, Doug, your auditors never make a mistake. And what's important is less focusing on the mistake as how is it being fixed and how are we moving forward. So I guess that would be one question for you based on what you have found. What do you feel is the way for the state to move forward?
Yeah, I alluded to this at the very beginning of our conversation today, and that is that in this case, the Agency of Commerce had dual responsibility: marketing, assisting the projects and the developers, and regulation. Admittedly, the regulation part, in their view from the outset, was very, very modest.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't yet at that point see that it could become this big deal about securities and fraud, but I wish they had seen that. I think they should have. And the fact that there's, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, and I think the point you're making there is one we should just, you know, make very clear to listeners: marketing and promoting something and regulating something are at odds with each other. And it may not be the smartest choice to have the same agency or the same office even do both.
Exactly. There is some literature about this. It's not a new idea. You know, the Agency of Commerce, again, I disagree with a lot of the policies and things they do, but they're not bad people.
No.
But when you get into that mindset and that culture, you are less likely to see the risks. That's what happens. It's a very subtle thing. It doesn't mean that they're bad people. They're trying to do what they perceive as a very important, straightforward, and appropriate and important job. And the alternative, as I mentioned, we have an example of it with the captive insurance program, which has serious regulators and the agency doing marketing. So it's not as if it hadn't been brought to their attention. It's happening every day in that program. So that's the biggest takeaway. I've talked about this before, however, and it's not just the Agency of Commerce. For example, the Agency of Agriculture.
Okay.
In a state like Vermont, with our history, of course, we all love ag, you know, except when it poisons the lake and then we have to pay to fix it up. So it's complicated.
Right.
It really is complicated. And there were things that we didn't know 50 years ago. And now we know. And there's a price tag for this stuff. But we've done a couple jobs involving the Agency of Agriculture, who were very capable people. But we're back to this question of how do you promote dairy, for example, or other types of ag? How do you get tough when they're struggling? Ag in a small state, you know, commodity agriculture in Vermont in the 21st century, you think, how can this possibly continue? You know, it's not a recipe for success, but we don't want them to disappear.
Right.
Because there are enormous ancillary benefits. They keep the land open. The tourists like the cows. You know, and I'm not making fun of it. It's all true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? But if we become aware of a downside that is societally a problem, whether it's the lake or something else, then we have to be honest and deal with it. That's why we're here. But the agency, as with the Agency of Commerce, their first instinct isn't going to be, I don't trust Bill Stenger, I'm going to nail this guy. Their thing is, how can I help them?
Right.
And again, good instincts, but we have a bigger picture here. And I'm not picking on the Agency of Agriculture. Also true, I think, to some extent, in the Agency of Natural Resources. Mm-hmm. They have a choice every day in terms of, do they want to start out as, you know, hard asses and in every case say, we became aware that Olga's business is doing so-and-so. We're going after Olga. No, their first response is, you know, let's find some way to get Olga to change her behavior
mm-hmm.
without going to court, without making Olga pay a big fine. And that is probably the right approach in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
Is it always the right approach?
And for listeners, I'm sorry, Doug has frozen. And I'm going to see if we can get him back. So bear with us. Thank you, viewers and listeners. We had technical issues, as we tend to have in Vermont when it comes to Wi-Fi and internet. So Doug Hoffer, State Auditor, thank you for coming back to the show to finish up. We were just quickly talking about moving forward. And so what are some of the, like, step one, step two, step three that you think the state should do to make sure that something like the EB-5 fraud doesn't happen again.
Yeah, the hardest part is admitting that we have a problem. Sounds familiar. Because, you know, the folks who are working in the trenches every day, they have a different view of this. Mm-hmm. I'm almost certain that they all feel like, hey, we're doing a great job. It's a hard job. You know, why are you giving us a hard time? But I think it's pretty clear to people from the outside that there is an inherent conflict. Mm-hmm. And again, that doesn't make these folks in the various entities bad people. It means that their decisions are influenced by stuff that is not evidence-based. It's mm-hmm. relationship-based, and it's all this other stuff. And I think we have an obligation as a state, as an administration, not me, but the, you know, the executive branch and the legislature together to identify where that may be occurring and how to prevent it or correct it. It may involve something as simple, don't mean to overstate it, moving environmental enforcement stuff related to farming from the Agency of Agriculture over to the Agency of Natural Resources, where that's their job. Mm-hmm. And they're not conflicted by the fact that they're trying to help farmers. It's a different approach entirely. The Agency of Commerce, some of the problem there is not like EB-5, because that was a brand new thing and had this other element that they didn't really see at the outset. But they have programs, as I alluded to before, that have conflicts embedded in them, mm-hmm. like the Veggie Business Incentive Program and others, where the same entity is charged with determining your eligibility and then deciding how much money we're going to give you. Where's the objectivity? You know, where are the checks and balances within the program? And they would have you believe that they're in the statute, and they're not. Mm-hmm. And they're not in the practice of some of these things. So this is a tough thing for legislators, for sure, because as soon as they say, next Tuesday, we're going to talk about this, the room is filled with lobbyists and business people. And if it's the Agency of Agriculture and the Committee on Agriculture says, we're going to talk about this, then the room is filled with those people. Mm-hmm. And that's as it should be. You know, people, businesses, farmers, everybody, we all have a right to go and be heard, for sure. But it's very difficult sometimes for a state rep or a state senator when the room is filled with your constituents who are saying, this program is great. You know, how many people can stand back and say, I hear you saying that, I want to learn more about it? Other people who may not agree with you. That's hard. That's really hard. I'm glad it's them and not me. And furthermore, the administration, you know, all of these folks in state government are subject to input from outside. They are all lobbied all the time. Governor's office, you know, agencies and departments, as well as elected officials in state house. But I think the evidence is clear that it's overdue for a conversation about some of this stuff. It's not an easy path, but you know, if we're not here to do the hard stuff, what's the point?
And on a very basic level, I would say when things like policies and procedures, best practices are very clear, it makes the process easier for everyone who has to engage in it, because everyone knows where the guardrails are.
Have you been an auditor in a former life?
No, but I have worked some jobs where very bad leadership and very bad policies, and you kind of learn what not to do. Unless there's anything else you want to mention about the EB-5 report, Doug, I'd love to hear what else your office is working on.
Sure. The endless TIF parade, the legislature, as you know, required my office to conduct audits of every single TIF district 3 times in their life cycle, mm-hmm. which means that effectively we have to do a TIF audit once or more a year for the next 20 years.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of work. And remind us what TIF districts are and why some people love them.
TIF is tax increment financing, and it's an opportunity for towns who may want to improve the infrastructure in their downtown to generate more interest in development in the downtown, which who's going to argue with that? The only question is, where does the money come from? Historically, when I moved to Vermont in the 80s, that's what the mayor and the city council would do. They'd say, we think we need more money for sidewalks or wastewater or housing or whatever it is, and here's our plan, and we have to borrow $4 million. Mm-hmm. Do you support that or not? And we have high bars in Vermont. If it's a general obligation bond, it's 2/3 approval by the voters. That's tough. If it's a revenue bond, it's 50 plus one. So anyway, these days, things have changed since the 80s. There isn't as much federal money, notwithstanding COVID. That was a unique thing. So they're, you know, and the state doesn't have as much money. So getting people to agree to raise their own taxes is a tough sell. So what they do now is they have this program called TIF where they say, this isn't going to cost you a dime. They define an area in your downtown of maybe 10 blocks square. Say, this is our TIF district. Its current value is, pick a number, $100 million. We want to do the following things: a new road, a new park, a new parking lot, green space, water and wastewater, whatever it might be, to encourage more people to come and invest here as opposed to out in a cornfield somewhere. That's going to cost a lot of money. We need $20 million. What we're going to do is say, okay, we know that this area currently generates, pick a number, $4 million a year in municipal and education tax revenue.
Okay.
If what we do, improving the infrastructure, achieves the outcomes we're looking for, which is more development, then the value of that district will go from 100 million to 110, 20, 30, and so forth. And we're going to assume that none of that increase in value would have happened, here it is again, but for this TIF. So what they do in effect is keep money that would have gone to the education fund for 20 years, most of the money that's part of that new increment of revenue from the new increment of investment. That basically, the Joint Fiscal Office has estimated that that's keeping $6 to $8 million a year out of the Ed Fund. But you can't spend less because the Education Fund is obligated to spend whatever the state and the municipalities agree upon in this crazy formula. So somebody else has got to pay that $6 to $8 million a year. So if Putney has a TIF, that means the rest of the state is making up for the money that you used to send to the Education Fund. We have to send that money in.
Oh, interesting.
We now have, you know, eight or more TIF districts. That's why it's so much money every year. I don't think it's a terribly good program, although I certainly agree with the goal, which is to help towns who are struggling with their downtowns to get the infrastructure that's required to help them grow. That's fine, because I like growth in downtowns. We all do. It makes more sense than out in the cornfields. Anyway, the TIF things are complicated as hell. We found a lot of problems with people doing their best to comply with the requirements and some not doing their best and making a mess of it. But it's a lot of work for my office. 15-20% of the entire resource of my office is devoted to TIF at any one time.
Oh, wow.
Can't say I'm happy about that.
Yeah.
So anyway, we have a TIF job coming out. We just finished up second of the two Burlington TIFs. They had some problems. We're finishing up Milton right now. After that, I think we go back to Winooski. This will be their final one because they started a long time ago. So that's TIF. We also have an interesting job on emergency management.
Oh, okay.
Related to natural disasters. The state has, as all states do, have requirements. If you want to get money from FEMA after a flood, you have to say, well, of course we have the special planning document that you require, and here it is. The problem is it seems like it's not really about doing everything that's in the plan. It's just having a plan to satisfy FEMA. And that doesn't mean the state doesn't do anything, but the report will tell us, okay, you had 100 items in the plan. How many did you actually do? FEMA's a weird beast, so it's strange. But they bring a lot of money in when we need it. So I don't question why we do what's required to get the money. The question is, if we're going to do that work, and we believe, and all the partners involved believe, that it's important to mitigate damage, then shouldn't we make those investments? That's one. The other is a holdover in COVID money, ARPA money, so-called, for economic development. We're back to the Agency of Commerce, which created a program 3 or 4 years ago called the Capital Investment Program, which is intended to reward businesses that are making capital investments in their business and not necessarily creating any more jobs.
Oh, interesting.
For example, all businesses, most businesses, not so much service businesses, but if you're a manufacturer and you know that there's some new equipment available that would make your workers more productive, and you know your competitors are buying that equipment, you've got to buy it. You have no choice. Or if you've been successful and you have 45 employees and you're bursting at the seams and you need more space, you need to double the size of your plant and more workers, right? Then you have no choice. Unless you can find a justification for staying at that size because that's all you want to manage and so forth. But generally speaking, capital investment is a must. You don't really have a choice. I'm not aware of any evidence that the businesses in Vermont are struggling to find money to do capital investment. If they're successful, then they should be a good bet for a bank or, you know, equity, other equity or so forth. So I don't know what to make of that program, but I do know that the legislature curiously, and I know the guy who did it, told the Agency of Commerce that in order to award these grants, we're going to ask the legislature's economist to work with the administration's economist to do what's called a net fiscal impact. If we're going to give you 500 grand, which is a portion of the total cost of what you need, which might be 3 million, then we're going to run those numbers through the model. We're back to the model and see what's that really worth.
Mm-hmm.
If you do that, put the but for aside for a moment. If you do that, what's the benefit to the state, not just to you and your shareholders and your mm-hmm. workers, mm-hmm. but how much more revenue do we get? How many more jobs and so forth? And they did that. And what that did is put a cap on what the agency could offer these businesses. They come in and say, I need 500 grand. And the model says, you're only worth 100.
Interesting.
Very different than what Veggie does. Because Veggie right. says, the model says we can give you 800 grand. Step on down. Come on down. That's what you get. But it's a different model with different assumptions. They came later. The governor went to the legislature the following year and said, you know, there's money left over in the federal pot that I want to use for a program like that and expand it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't give it to me, I'm not going to approve your budget. So the legislature said, oh, we don't have the votes to override. We got to give them the money. And it was $30 or $40 million, mm-hmm. which doesn't sound like a lot in an $8 billion state budget. But think of all the things that you could do with $30 or $40 million.
Yeah.
Homelessness comes to mind. Anyway, so they created another program that was very similar, but didn't have the analysis of the two economists.
Interesting. So
the agency got to decide how much to give people.
Okay.
So we'll be reporting to a theater near you sometime in about 6 weeks.
Yes, about the hopes versus the reality is kind of what it sounds like. Yeah.
So we have some other stuff going on that's a little premature, so I'll leave that for later. But appreciate the chance to talk about our work, sure.
Remind folks, you have a newsletter that your office puts out, and how can people sign up for? I always find it very interesting. So how can people sign up for your newsletter if they're interested?
Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there are times when not everybody has the inclination or commits the time to read a 40-page report. Although there is usually a transmittal letter, which is with a brief summary, executive summary, which is usually 2 pages. But these newsletters are anywhere between 1.5 and 3 pages, boom. Mm-hmm. And the one on this, on EB5, is very helpful, because yeah. there's so much detail in the report. And I tried to talk about the stuff that we've been discussing here, the kind of the takeaways. If they go to my website, our website, you know, auditor.gov, to state government, go to the auditor's office. And if you look up at the top bar, one of the options, in addition to reports and in the news, is newsletter. Just go there and open the latest one. And at the bottom of that document will be a place to subscribe.
Okay.
And if for any reason that doesn't work or you're not satisfied, then contact my office and somebody will help you for sure.
Well, State Auditor Doug Hoffer, thank you for coming on the show and talking us through the EB5 report and what you're working on now. And always a pleasure. I look forward to having Indeed. You on the show again.
For me as well. Thank you, Olga. I appreciate it.
For listeners, as you know, the Montpelier Happy Hour is on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station, every Friday at 2 p.m., rebroadcasted on Wednesday, and of course, wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. Have a good weekend, everyone. Take care.
Thanks, everyone.